This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the end of the American War in Vietnam.
Congress voted the Department of Defense $65 million to be used over the span of 12 years to rewrite and distort both the history of the war in Vietnam and the opposition to it here in America.
Joining us today will be Susan Schnall, Jim Lafferty, and Doug Rawlings to look at different perspectives about the war.
Susan Schnall was an active duty resistor to the war in Vietnam. Doug Rawlings came home and organized against it. Jim Lafferty was an anti-draft lawyer and one of the principal organizers of the mass demonstrations against the war.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
From 1967 to 1969 during the Vietnam War, Lieutenant J.G. Susan Schnall was a Navy nurse stationed in a hospital in Oakland, California, treating wounded Marines. She and other soldiers threw anti-war leaflets out of an airplane on an army base in California. For this, she received a general court-martial and was cashiered out of the Navy in 1969. She is an expert on the effects of Agent Orange, the chemical used by the United States to commit chemical warfare against the Vietnamese people and land. Schnall is a member of the Veterans for Peace and Vietnam Veterans Against the War. She is a leading core member of the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. Currently, she is an adjunct assistant professor at New York University's School of Continuing Professional Studies, teaching health policy and planning. Susan Schnall, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Tell us briefly how you got involved in the anti-war movement.
From 1967 to 1969, I was a nurse in the United States Navy at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital in Oakland, California, and I took care of returning soldiers and Marines who had been to Vietnam and returned with terrible, terrible wounds. They spoke a lot about their experiences in Vietnam, the terrible death and destruction that they witnessed, how frightened they were. My patients were about 18, 19 years old. They were all enlisted personnel. And they spoke not just about their fear, but they also talked about what they had seen and their attitude towards the Vietnamese, how they identified them as the other and the enemy, and decided that they could destroy anything that moves. As time went on, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, what I am witnessing is my part in this conflict. I had gone into the Navy thinking I could undo the damage and destruction that was being done by the government by healing the wounds of war. And then I found myself a part of that very process of destruction. There was planning for a GI and Veterans March for Peace in October of 1968. And I decided to attend the meetings and to join the demonstration. We attempted to get publicity about the demonstration on the military base where I was working and in the hospital, but it became impossible. And I remembered seeing stories about how the United States was distributing flyers from airplanes in South and Central Vietnam that was urging the Vietnamese to go to these protected hamlets to avoid being bombed by the United States military. And I thought, well, if the United States could do this in a country so many thousands of miles away, why couldn't we distribute these flyers announcing the peace demonstration on military bases in the San Francisco Bay Area? I had a friend who was a pilot, and we loaded up the airplane with the flyers announcing the peace demonstration, and we dropped them on military bases, on the Presidio, on Treasure Island, on Yerba Buena Island, on Oak Knoll Hospital, and then flew over to Alameda Naval Air Station, and we dropped the flyers on an aircraft carrier.
And we're talking hundreds of flyers?
Oh, yes. And then held a press conference to say, you know, in my uniform. And I said, you know, I am a member of the military, and I am here to say that there are those of us in the service who want to work for peace, who want to stop what's going on in Southeast Asia.
I vividly remember that action, Susan, and I remember how effective it was in terms of turning out GIs. I mean, who more than anyone had a right to protest the war but GI themselves? And I also remember what happened to you afterwards. Could you tell our audience what happened to you?
Sure. I was tried by general court-martial for two charges under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. One was conduct on becoming an officer and a gentlewoman, I guess, for dropping those flyers because the government felt that that was to cause disloyalty in the American military. And the second charge was wearing my uniform publicly while promoting my political ideas. And I was found guilty of both charges. But, you know, my defense was if General Westmoreland could go before Congress and request millions of dollars to support this war, then as a member of the military, I had those same rights and, in fact, had a responsibility to say to people, there are those of us in the military who oppose this war and this conflict.
Well, sure. Even though you were a soldier, you were still a citizen.
Yes.
You don't lose your rights as a citizen when you put on the uniform.
And you were a healthcare professional.
Yes. And, you know, and the other defense was the issue of the Nuremberg trials, that as a military person, we had not only the right to speak out publicly, but we had a responsibility when we felt that there were illegal, immoral, unjustified conflict, and the military never really considered that argument.
Susan, can you talk a bit about the devastating effects of Agent Orange dioxin and the work that you've been doing to raise awareness of this?
This really is a process that began in about 1972 when I was going around talking about the war and working with an organization called Medical Aid to Indochina. I had received some photographs from Vietnam of children who had been impacted by the use of Agent Orange dioxin in Vietnam. It was before we really had studies. But there was alarm in the Vietnamese community that children were being born with these terrible birth defects and with cognitive problems, devastating cognitive issues, not being able to relate to other people, problems that would carry them through the rest of their lives. And then in 2006, I visited Vietnam and went to a hospital, Tadu Hospital, that had a number of children who had been impacted by the use of Agent Orange dioxin. And I saw their terrible, terrible birth defects, physical disfigurement, distorted limbs, mobility impairment, speech impairment. They looked like what Dr. Fung described, who had worked with them for many years, quote, monsters, because they were so distorted and so terribly disfigured. And when I came back to the U.S., I just said, you know, we need to deal with this issue. At that time, the group I work with, the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign, was working on a legal suit on behalf of Vietnamese nationals against the chemical companies that produced the Agent Orange dioxin. So we worked for a number of years promoting the legal case and then losing in court, and then went to work on legislation.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about that, because this horrific chemical warfare campaign that the United States conducted ruined thousands and thousands of Vietnamese and also American soldiers and their families, and the defects are transmitted from generation to generation. So I understand that there's legislation now that's been introduced into Congress, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Currently, the Veterans Administration covers a number of different illnesses for American veterans who had boots on the ground from 1961 to 1971. There are about 14, 15 different types of illnesses, including respiratory cancers, Parkinson's disease, and a number of significant heart problems. The Veterans Administration also covers the disabilities and birth defects for the children of female American veterans. There are about 14 different birth defects that are primarily what we call neural tube defects, and they're covered. What is not covered are the children of American male veterans who were in Vietnam during that period of time. The only birth defect that is currently covered is spina bifida for the children of American male veterans. We have provided very, very little in the way of any kind of services for the millions of Vietnamese who were harmed by the use of Agent Orange dioxin, who have terrible crippling diseases now, or for their children, their progeny, their successive generations, children who continue to be born with these very severe birth defects, with defects like hydrocephalus, with atrophied limbs, with terrible cognitive deficiencies. This is the lasting legacy of the American war in Vietnam, and it's something that I believe we have responsibility to deal with.
Apart from the 3 million Vietnamese who were killed during the war, 3 million civilians, quite intentionally, there are hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese that are still suffering. Is the United States doing anything in terms of reparations for them?
The United States doesn't really give reparations. There have been some monies allocated for the cleanup of one of 28 hotspots that remain in Vietnam. And that one hotspot is Da Nang Airport. So there's about $65, $70 million that currently is being spent to clean up that one area. As I mentioned, there's 27 other remaining hotspots. There are a couple of million dollars, a few million dollars that have been allocated to assist children with physical disabilities. It's not anywhere near the amount of money that's needed to take care of the children. And there is no recognition on the part of the American government that these disabilities were in fact caused by the use of Agent Orange dioxin. It's simply looked at as kind of a humanitarian effort.
When you mention the hot spots, the other hot spots, am I understanding that to be land that continues to be contaminated by a dioxin?
Absolutely. And these hot spots actually were American military bases during the conflict. There was not just the spraying that we always see from the C-123 airplanes, but there was the use by helicopters, the spraying by helicopters. There were American servicemen that sprayed these areas, the perimeters of the bases, using backpacks. So all of these folks were heavily contaminated, as well as the land in Vietnam. And those are the hot spots that remain to be cleaned up, where the American military had their bases.
And are the hot spots off limit to civilians? Are they fenced off?
There are some fences around some of the worst hot spots, certainly around Da Nang, Bien Hoa, and a little bit towards the middle part of the country in Alui. But it would be very difficult to be able to fence off all of those areas. And it's important to remember that today Vietnam is a developing country because, as Curtis LeMay said, you know, we attempted to bomb them into the Stone Age. So it was a matter of our being responsible for their lack of development for all of those years during the war. And now that they're moving into kind of an industrialized age, there are certain focus that the government has. Some of it is to clean up. Some of it is actually to identify the victims of the Agent Orange and be able to provide some services for them. But it's not anywhere near what the need is.
Susan Schnall, let's talk about what's going on now, because there's an effort on the part of the Department of Defense and other pseudo-patriots to rewrite the history of the war in Vietnam. And I know you've been cognizant of this and speaking about it. Can you talk to us about that, please?
About a year ago, the U.S. Congress passed legislation to be able to promote and pay for a commemoration regarding the United States' involvement in the war and conflict in Vietnam. And as President Obama said, it was to pay homage to the valor of a generation that served with honor, fighting heroically to protect the ideals we hold dear as Americans. What he doesn't talk about and what this bill doesn't talk about is the terrible suffering of the people in Vietnam, of our own veterans, and of the responsibilities we have to heal those wounds of war. The United States, as far as a group of us are concerned in Veterans for Peace, is to serve to further legitimize and justify ongoing policies of unnecessary and destructive warfare. We have a project called Toward an Honest Commemoration of the American War in Vietnam. So please, listeners, go to the website, take a look at the materials that are up there. It's really important and informative, and it tells the truth of what we did in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia.
And I'll give you a website if you get a pen. It's called Vietnam Full Disclosure. And the website is VietnamFullDisclosure.org. And you can learn from that website exactly what's going on. I recall Orwell's famous statement about he who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. So that's, I think, what you just said, Susan, is what's so terribly troubling, that they're using this rewrite of the aggressive war against Vietnam to pave the way for more wars in the Middle East.
Absolutely, absolutely. And to focus on, of course, the valor of American troops, and to not focus on the policies of the United States government and the implication of these multinational, international corporations that are feeding these wars and causing this death and destruction. I'd like to mention our legislation.
Please.
April 30th, which is identified in many minds as the end of the war in Vietnam. Congresswoman Barbara Lee from Northern California introduced H.R. 2114, the Victims of Agent Orange Relief Act of 2015, into the House. The points of the legislation are to provide medical assistance and disability benefits to the affected children of American Vietnam veterans, to provide health care and social services for the Vietnamese, also to provide health care for the affected Vietnamese Americans, which we don't do, and to remediate and clean up the lands and the ecosystems in Vietnam that were harmed by the use of these chemicals. And we need everybody's support. We need you to call your legislators and ask them to co-sponsor the legislation and to keep talking about it in groups and educating the American public.
Susan, thank you for your contribution to the anti-war movement.
Thank you, but I really think it's so important to talk about all of the veterans who were once part of the military, who saw war and conflict, and came back now to struggle for peace and social justice issues. I find them remarkable, and it really is an honor for me to work with them, to work with Veterans for Peace, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and our local Veterans Peace Council.
Former Lieutenant Junior Grade Susan Schnall, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
When the United States government escalated its war in Vietnam in 1965, Detroit attorney Jim Lafferty, who was a leader of the National Lawyers Guild and an attorney representing draft resisters, became active in what became the mass movement opposing the American war. Jim was one of the five national coordinators of the National Peace Action Coalition and played a central role in the huge anti-war demonstrations in 1967 and 1969 and 1971. Jim remains active to this day in the anti-war movement opposing America's efforts in Iraq, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, and anywhere else America attempts to impose its imperial hand.
Jim Lafferty, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jim, we'd like to start by hearing a bit about your personal and political background.
Yeah, well, after I graduated law school in Michigan, where I'd grown up, I became the national director of the National Lawyers Guild, and at that period of time in the mid-60s. And a young woman came to my office one day and said, hey, you know, there's this war in Vietnam, and we're going to form a movement against it. And I said, yeah, I've heard about it, but there's not half a dozen people in town who could find it on a map. But she persisted, and she was right, and she thought we could build a movement. And so I formed something along with her called the Detroit Committee to End the War in Vietnam. And much to my amazement, very quickly, not only students, but ministers and labor folks and all sorts of folks in Detroit gathered around that coalition, and it became a big coalition. And at the same time, of course, other coalitions were forming all over the country, too. And protests were beginning to happen, sometimes small at first, but there was now a movement. And it was somewhat surprising because this was not long after the big anti-communist scares. The reason that the country, of course, was giving for the war was that we had to, stop communism. The real reason was not that, and I assume we'll get to that in this interview. But that was kind of my background, what brought me into it. A little bit kicking and screaming, initially not believing that such a movement, frankly, could be built. Wasn't sure it could be, but knew that morally I should be part of it, and so off we went.
Well, let's go to the stated reasons, stopping communism, the domino effect. All Southeast Asia will go communist. Those were the stated reasons. But what do you think, Jim, were the real reasons?
Well, those were not unrelated to the real reason. The real reason was, of course, U.S. imperialism and wanting to have a free hand in free markets and free access to markets, whether it was oil in the Middle East or whatever. There was actually a lot of tin and tungsten and all sorts of minerals in Vietnam, in fact, that the United States had its hand on. It used the anti-communist scare because that resonated with the people of this country to a certain extent. And there was some truth to it in the sense that to the extent that the world became socialist or communist, it wouldn't tolerate, of course, U.S. imperialism and U.S. Corporations are raping the resources of the world. So they just didn't give the second half of that reason, that was all.
Well, they started the war. In 1965, it began a horrible escalation. And within a few years, there were over 500,000 troops there. How was that war conducted?
Well, it was a vicious war. War crimes aplenty were committed, if you will. Most of the country has at some time or another here now heard about Agent Orange, of course, and the defoliation agents and the burning down of entire villages and so forth, bombing attacks. Of course, we were fighting a people that didn't have that kind of a military. The Vietnamese had no air force as such. They had no huge tank divisions and so forth and so on. So we were violating the rules of war in terms of proportionality. We were using cluster bombs, anti-personnel bombs that, split in a million pieces when they land. And we were indiscriminately killing women and children and civilians and, as I say, burning the simple villages that the Vietnamese had built up. So it was a war on a civilian population. It was a war designed to break the will of the Vietnamese people. And it was conducted with a massive U.S. force, as I say, contrary to more rules of war than we have time to go into today.
Jim, how did the Vietnamese resist?
Well, that's of course, one of the great stories of history. At one point was 1971, along with other anti-war leaders, had been invited to Hanoi, and I had a chance to meet with then Premier Van Van Dong. And Phan Van Dong and the six or seven of us had quite an interview. And I said to Phan Van Dong, I asked him, why everywhere I went in North Vietnam, they were so confident they were going to be able to win this war against the greatest military machine that the world had ever seen. And he smiled, and his answer was, of course, that they'd been fighting for their liberation for 1,000 years, the French and the British and the Chinese and what have you. And whereas the American people had no sense of history, by which he meant no sense of how long struggle can be, or a quick fix nation and a quick food McDonald's kind of a nation, you know, they were prepared to, because it was their land and their freedom and their independence, their sovereignty, they were prepared to fight forever. So they fought it in trenches. They built tunnels miles and miles and miles long. I saw some of those tunnels where they would crawl through on their hands and knees carrying their modest weapons. They had caves in some of the islands in Haiphong Harbor in which they would manufacture what military equipment they had and then bring it ashore and smuggle it to the south through those tunnels, all against, as I say, the most mighty military power the earth had ever seen. And yet it didn't take long before it was pretty clear if our own military advisors and our own politicians were going to be honest. I mean, McNamara himself admits later on in the books that he writes after the war that it was pretty clear to him early on this was a war we could not win, but we continued bombing, we continued destroying the country nevertheless.
And what were the consequences for the Vietnamese, Jim?
Well, millions, billions dead. Years. It took years after the U.S. was finally thrown out of Vietnam, in terms of just landmines alone, in terms of the defoliation. Some of the villages, because they were built with bamboo and what have you, could be reconstructed rather quickly. But the toll on the Vietnamese people was extraordinary. And the fact that they were able to carry on life as they did, I found always quite amazing. Even during the war, when I was in Hanoi, I had occasion to go to Bac Mai Hospital the morning after it was bombed. And the hospital was carrying on as always. The people were in the streets as always, going about their business, all working together for a common cause. You had a real sense when you were in Hanoi in 1971, the war hadn't ended yet, that this was a war in which the entire country was in it together, as opposed to in the United States, of course, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, where the Vietnam War became arguably the most divisive issue in this country since, I don't know, slavery, perhaps.
You know, Jim, you and I were active together, of course, in Detroit against the war. I remember the first anti-war demonstration against an ongoing American war. It was like unheard of in this country.
Yeah.
When Eugene Debs gave an anti-war speech against the First World War, they put him in prison for it. And the first demonstration, we thought, was amazing. There were 25,000 people in Washington demonstrating against the war in Vietnam. We thought that was amazing. And then towards the end, and you were part of the leadership in this, there were 500,000 people would come down and surround the Pentagon. And I wanted to talk to you about that.
Yeah. And number one, this was a war that was televised. And it was televised in the very here and now of the war. You could turn on the evening news and see a village being torched and the women and children running and screaming away. And the look on Walter Cronkite's face as he reported that. You had knowledge of the war sweeping and the nature of the war sweeping very quickly over the American people. Secondly, you had a draft. And you had a draft into a war which people were uncertain of at best. Those who were certain of it may have volunteered or were in the military, but the rank-and-file young men of this country who were facing a draft had questions, especially based on what they had seen on their television screens, as I say. So rather quickly, the families of those sons, the daughters, the girlfriends, what have you, formed a movement saying, we don't want to go. We don't want any part of this war. It doesn't make any sense, and what we're doing there is despicable and something that we just don't want to be a part of. That, I think, was a major factor, both, as I say, the fact that the war came into our homes in a very clear and real sense, as-it's-happening sense, if you will, and the fact that people were not being given a choice as to whether or not they were going to fight or not, but rather were being drafted to go and fight this war they had seen depicted in such a vicious way on television.
We're speaking with Jim Lafferty on the 40th anniversary of the Vietnam War. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jim Lafferty on the anniversary of the Vietnam War.
And being killed, there were over 53,000 Americans who would be shipped back in coffins with flags over them. And that, of course, was all on television, too.
Yeah, unlike more recent wars where the administration has made sure that we didn't see those flag-draped coffins coming back. Here they were coming back by the plane load and by the shipload. They were on the news every night. And so, again, the reality of the war here at home was what the war meant to the people here at home was becoming very clear to more and more American people. And the more that was true, the more this war that Lyndon Johnson famously once said, we're not going to let a bunch of little dwarfs with knives defeat us. You know, this notion that this would be a quick war, when have we heard that before?
Yeah, yellow dwarfs, he actually said.
Yellow
dwarfs,
exactly.
You have to credit him for being the racist that he was.
Yes, and of course it wasn't quick at all, and it began to drag on and on and on, and with every passing year the opposition to it grew stronger and stronger. And it became a political issue in political campaigns as well. You know, depending on the district you lived in and the liberal nature of that district and how much it was involved in the anti-war movement, determined whether or not you were going to be electable to Congress or not. It is certainly true that the American people had turned against the war long before the Congress did. And we can talk about that in a minute, why that was so. But nevertheless, it became an issue in the political campaigns as well. Indeed, it's the reason Lyndon Johnson ultimately decided not to seek another term, after all.
Jim, speaking of political parties, what was the role of liberals, and especially the Democrats?
Well, initially they supported the war full on. I mean, they were an imperialist party, too, and they supported the war full on. Oh, they may wanted to have talked a little bit more about encouraging negotiations, or they might have been in favor of a truce to stop bombing the Vietnamese on Christmas Eve or something. But that was about as far as their humanity or their opposition to the war went, certainly initially. That was true. So the movement was not built by them at all. Of course, the movement was built by the left in this country and by political parties on the left in this country, the role of the Socialist Workers' Party in this country, the Communist Party in this country, other socialists and
radical pacifists,
A.J.
Musty, Dave Dellinger.
Yep, radical pacifists as well played a key role in it. And the anti-draft movement, of course, played a key role in it because, as I say, the opposition to the draft. And that's really who built the movement. Oh, we would invite to the demonstrations any member of Congress who had a decent anti-war position, and there were a few, certainly. The senators from Oregon and Wyoming, for example, were opposed to the war almost from the beginning. But the stage was made up at the anti-war rallies. The stage was made up of rank-and-file folks in this country, mothers against the war, and business people against the war, who understood the war was not even in imperialist capitalist interest. And veterans against the war groups were formed, of course, students against the war because of what it was doing to decimating the college populations. All of these various constituencies, the gay rights movement, the women's movement, the African-American movement, because minorities were being drafted in disproportionate numbers, the draft that discriminated against people who were poor and minorities in this country and with respect to every deferment. And so there were reasons why all sectors of the American population knew this was not a war that was in their interest. Muhammad Ali famously saying, no Vietnamese ever called me the N-word. So
I got no fight with the Viet Cong. But let me ask you this, Jim.
Kong.
Because there was this massive anti-war movement amongst civilians, how did that affect GIs themselves in the Army? Was there much resistance to the war by GIs themselves?
Yeah. By 1971, Colonel Heinel is quoted in Army Times as saying that we're no longer drafting an army, we're drafting an anti-war movement, which is demoralized, which is dragging its officers, which is getting drugged out on dope. And, of course, the reason for that, I don't know whether he knew it or not, the reason for that is because this army, quote-unquote, that he thought he was drafting were the same people who had been marching in the streets against the war, or their brothers, or their sisters, or their mothers, the same people who opposed the war and who did not go to Vietnam willingly to fight, as many did in other wars, perhaps, but not during this war. And so what happened was, within the military itself, and, Mike, you know this as well as anybody, the military itself organized, soldiers themselves organized within the military, coffee houses and resistance movements, and they paid the price for it in some cases. But it spread like wildfire in the military itself because they knew the war at home was not supported. They themselves had not supported it when they were in civilian life. And as the saying became rather quickly, no guy wanted to be the last guy to die in Vietnam.
We'd like to ask you how the history of the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement also have been distorted.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there was after the war, there was a great deal of talk, and it was honest talk about the Vietnam syndrome. In other words, this was the first war, and I think Michael mentioned, this is the first war in which the majority of the American people came to oppose a war in which their own brethren were fighting and dying, and that their country was, you know, that's a pretty remarkable thing. And so for a while there was, after that, so-called Vietnam syndrome, which of course had, among other things, had the impact of, number one, the draft was then abandoned because the draft provided such a boost to an anti-war movement. They had to get rid of that. And the war was now being fought more with a so-called all-volunteer army, of course, a poverty draft of sorts, what it was, and other wars would be fought from the air with new and more hideous war weaponry than we even had during Vietnam. But the history of the war itself, that Vietnam syndrome, while it may still be alive to a certain extent, the history itself was distorted. Oh, if only we hadn't had this silly movement against it. Oh, if only people would have understood what we're doing. Oh, if only we could have just stayed a little longer. You know, Richard Nixon had a secret plan, he said, to end the war. His secret plan was to bomb the dikes. If you know anything about Vietnam, you know that had a massive bombing of the dikes, Vietnam would have basically flooded the country and millions more would have died. That was his secret plan, and he says in his memoir, but it was the anti-war movement in the streets that prevented him from doing that. So you see, it was not that it wasn't a just war. It was not that it wasn't a war that the U.S. could win. It was just these crazy commies and radicals and know-nothings at home that prevented those in charge who knew better from doing what could have been done. And therefore, the Vietnam War was a winnable war. It was a war we should have won, and so forth and so on. All of which is nonsense, of course, but that's the story today.
Jim, given the recent history of protracted invasions and so-called perpetual war, what lessons should we draw from Vietnam and the anti-war movement then?
Well, we should do all we can to keep the Vietnam syndrome alive, by which I simply mean we should do all we can to make people question any time the U.S. wants to go to war. I mean, that is the most important decision any government makes and any people make, to go to war. And in these times, given the kinds of weapons that exist, it's no small thing to do it, if it ever, not that it ever was. So we should always be questioning any time our government says why they want to go to war. I mean, that was true with Iraq and Afghanistan. We were told, oh, it had something to do with Bin Laden. It had something to do with fighting terrorism and so forth. When it was pretty clear to anybody who was paying attention that it was about oil. Obama himself slipped at one point when he was talking about Afghanistan a year or two ago and mentioned our oil interests having to do with the pipeline that goes through Afghanistan. So one should always be suspicious of it. And it's harder today because you don't have the draft and you don't have people, therefore, paying attention to a war in a foreign place as astutely as they should be paying attention to it. So those who know better and believe that any free people should always question any war that their government wants to get them into should be questioning any time. We should be questioning now the so-called war on ISIS, which is a war we should not be fighting and have no business in and have no real stake in. Again, it's just an effort to make sure that we preserve our dominance in the Middle East and our access to the oil and the other resources in that region of the world. But it's tougher today to build anti-war movements because of the lack of a draft. As we've seen, I think the recent movement against the war in Iraq certainly helped shorten that war, but it was not able to be as effective as the anti-Vietnam War movement was. And by the way, it should be noted and should be made clear that, yes, the massive movement against the war in this country, which involved basically every constituency in the country and around the world, there's a massive movement against it, was critical to ending the Vietnam War when it ended, because after all, it ended under Johnson and Nixon, hardly men of peace, you know. But the victories on the battlefield by the Vietnamese, we were talking about the way in which they fought earlier, without those victories on the battlefield by the Vietnamese, the anti-war movement would not have been able to be as effective as it was. I suppose we might say this, so long as we have a capitalist oligarchy and a capitalist oligarchy running this country, we're going to have wars of intervention, because they people don't voluntarily give up their resources, don't voluntarily give up their sovereignty, don't voluntarily get out of the way so that the corporate America, because profits can grow greater and greater. So I fear that there's going to be a need for an anti-war movement and an anti-imperialist movement, if you will, if we hope to finally get this country in a position where it is not not only the major manufacturing of weaponry and the sale of weaponry, but the use of that weaponry, as it has 140 military bases all over the world. It is indeed the policeman of the world, the jailer of much of the world. And that's because I think capitalism and the capitalist oligarchy that runs this country needs that military might to continue to feed its hungry craw.
Yeah, I think it's 1,000 bases or more in 100 different countries around the world.
I meant to say 140 yeah. different countries.
But yes, Jim, I just wanted to recall to you a friend of ours, now dead for many years, who, along with you, was one of the leaders nationally of the anti-war movement. And I'm talking about Fred Halstead.
Yes.
And Fred would recall when he spoke the First World War and the opposition to it in the Russia, which became the Soviet Union. And the opposition to it was based on three slogans. Peace was one. And bread, and land. They wanted a land reform for the peasants. They wanted a decent share of the resources for poor people. And they wanted an end to the war. And Fred used to say that the Russian Revolution was the greatest anti-war movement of them all.
Well, I think that's true, of course. I think that's true, of course. And by the way, the bread and land, I mean, the cost of the war domestically, the cost of the Vietnam War, the cost of all of the wars that the U.S. imperialists fight, on domestic programs, on the welfare of our people here in this country, as we're slaughtering and killing millions and destroying the lands of other people, is also a key ingredient, of course, as to why an anti-war movement can be built and needs to be built, and I suspect that's what Fred was alluding to in part as well, of course. And Fred was one of the great leaders of the anti-war movement, part of the Socialist Workers Party at the time, which was very active in the movement and understood the out-and-out position. That, by the way, is something we haven't talked about very quickly. There were quickly developed rather two strains in the anti-war movement around demands. One was to set the date for withdrawal of U.S. troops, sign a peace treaty, and so forth. The other was no out-now, leave immediately. And those of us who argued out-now, the National Peace Action Coalition and others, said, look, if you have no right to be there, yet we understand the war may end through some sort of negotiations, but it's not our business to say to the Vietnamese you ought to negotiate for your sovereignty. You have every right to have us out of your country tomorrow. We never should have gone in the first place. And whereas if you take the other position, we argued, of set the date, that date keeps moving, it keeps moving, it keeps moving. Look how it's moved in Iraq. Look how it's moved in Afghanistan, and we're not really all out of there yet. So that was a debate in the movement. The largest protests we had, of course, were when the two major coalitions, the one that supported the set the date and the other, ours that supported out now, when we came together, of course, unity in the movement produced the largest protest.
I just wanted to mention the best book that I know of about how the anti-war movement was built was Fred Halstead's book called Out Now.
Exactly.
And a book that mentions you, Jim. Anyway, we're running out of time here, so I wanted to thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Jim, always a pleasure.
It's mutual, I know. It really is. You know how much I enjoy it, how much I admire your show. And I have the good fortune of going to be seeing Heidi in a couple of days here in Los Angeles, and I greatly look forward to that.
Well, that's because you're being honored by the Los Angeles chapter of the National Lawyers Guild for several decades of good work out there. Heidi's going to be speaking at the dinner. So congratulations, Jim, and thank you so much for being our guest.
Bye-bye.
Thank you all. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care.
As we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the American War in Vietnam, many believe that the U.S. government is attempting to reshape the historical record, omitting the perspectives of anti-war protesters and of disaffected and nonconforming soldiers and their families. Also missing are the narratives of Southeast Asians who suffered from misguided and disastrous foreign policies. Veterans for Peace has launched a full disclosure campaign, calling on Americans to write letters to the soldiers whose names appear on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. They urge everyone with a role in the Vietnam War, be it war resister, combatant, family member, conscientious objector, or citizen, to share their memories and perspectives. Joining us to talk about the campaign is Doug Rawlings from Veterans for Peace.
Vietnam veteran Doug Rawlings, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much.
Doug, give the our listeners an idea of your background, would you please?
Oh, sure. Well, I was born in Rochester, New York, and had graduated from college in 1968 in Cleveland, Ohio, and decided that I was going to go to graduate school, and then I got drafted. And eventually sent to Vietnam in July of 1969. Through August of 70, I served with the 715th Battalion Artillery in the Central Highlands of Vietnam. We were our job was to support the 173rd Airborne. So I spent 13 and a half months in Vietnam, and I was stupid and confused and didn't have the moral fiber that required me resisting getting sucked into that war. So I came out of it very angry, very disillusioned. Moved up to Boston, then moved up to Seattle, and moved back to Boston, got a master's degree, and started teaching English and various things like that. And in 1985, I had moved up in the late 70s, I'd moved up to Central Maine. But in 1985, a fellow who had gone down to Nicaragua with a protection program down there was going around talking about that, and at the end of his talk here in Farmington, Maine, he said, I'm looking for some veterans who are interested in forming a peace group. And I said, yeah, that sounds good to me. So five of us formed Veterans for Peace in 1985 here in Maine, and now we have about 4,000 members. We have chapters in every state in the nation. We have international chapters in London, England, and Hanoi, Vietnam. We have NGO status with the United Nations. We're a very active group. So I'm caught up in that, and I have since, a couple of years ago, retired from the university where I taught for 27 years, and I'm trying to figure out what to do with my life now, but a lot of it's being occupied by our anger at what the government is trying to do, Pentagon is trying to do about revising the history of the Vietnam War.
So and Doug, we're coming up on the 40th and 50th anniversary, the beginning and the end of the Vietnam War. What is the Obama administration trying to do in terms of characterizing our role in that?
Yeah, well, I see it as a pretty insidious move myself. What Obama and his administration, the Pentagon and Department of Defense are doing is basically saying, you know, Vietnam veterans did not receive their due regard at the end of the war for their valorous duty and honorable, noble work within the military, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we want to do, says the government, is to have a number of commemorations for the next 10 years acknowledging, you know, the valor of the American soldier. And, of course, we're looking at the thing saying, you know, they're totally taking everything out of context, not including, of course, the suffering of the Vietnamese people, not to mention all the Southeast Asian people who are caught up in our war. They're not looking at the resistance to the war at home as well as resistance within the military. We think what they're trying to do is lay the groundwork for future wars, that if they can dust off the Vietnam War and call it a noble enterprise, then they can move forward and, you know, and follow other adventures.
Well, let me read to you, Doug, what Obama said, because we're talking about a $65 million program
right.
that the Department of Defense is getting to organize some 10,000 corporations and other organizations to put forward this rewrite of history. And Obama said, quote, "As we observe the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War, we pay tribute to the more than 3 million servicemen and women who pushed through the jungles and rice paddies, heat and monsoon, fighting heroically to protect the ideals we hold dear as Americans." Doug, when somebody comes up to you and wants to thank you for serving in Vietnam, how do you feel and what do you say?
Well, it depends on the situation. If I'm in a grocery store and for some reason some young clerk says, "Thank you for your service," I'll let it go by. But for the most part, what I do is I say, "Wait a minute, don't thank me for that." You know, I'm in fact mortified by the fact that I served in the Army in Vietnam and was involved in that war. So I consider it to be an immoral and an unjust enterprise, and I do not want to be thanked for that service at all.
Why do you say that, Doug?
Well, because it was built on lies. The whole enterprise was, you know, supposedly to provide democracy and freedom for the Vietnamese people. But we, of course, know, if we read our history carefully, if we read Christian Appy, if we read Nick Terse, et cetera, et cetera, we realize that the war itself was, in fact, you know, an act of, well,
weapons of mass destruction.
Sure.
Bush
right.
said that Iraq had yeah. weapons of mass destruction. It yeah. turned out to be a lie.
Right.
And Johnson said in 1964
right. Right.
At the yeah. Gulf of Tonkin yeah. incident that there was an attack on American ships.
Right.
And that
yeah.
turned out to be a lie also.
Right. Well, you know, this is how clever they are. They could make a case. And if you go to the Department of Defense's Pentagon's timeline and their, you know, big blog about the war, they will acknowledge the fact that the second attack was questionable. But, they think the first attack, you know, happened. And some people say, well, maybe it did. But, again, the idea was, the context was, this was not just an American ship, you know, sort of coasting along doing nothing. They were involved in raids throughout, down and up and down the coast. They were involved in lots of different things going on there. And so they were asking for it to one degree. And if you look at their timeline, they'll say that. They'll say, well, the second one was questionable. Then everything, but all references after that still refer to two attacks on the USS Maddox, right, which was,
But that gave them the green light
yeah.
To start sending troops into
yeah.
Vietnam, start yeah. bombing North Vietnam.
Right. Yep.
And
yep.
From 1965,
right.
Within
March
a couple of short
yeah.
years,
yeah.
they had 500,000 people over there, including yep. Doug Rawlings.
That's right. And it topped out at 540,000, I think. Yeah, yeah. When I was, I do this interesting thing when I go to Washington, D.C. I call it walking the wall. I go to the panel that designates July 2nd, 1969, when I arrived in Vietnam, and I walk it to August 9th, 1970, when I left Vietnam, and that's 25 paces on the wall. It's 9,800, approximately, guys who were killed in that span of time that I was there. It took its toll on me, for sure.
Well, Doug, you're involved in what you call the Full Disclosure Project,
mm-hmm.
Towards an honest commemoration of the American War in Vietnam.
Right.
What are you and your comrades doing with this Full Disclosure, and what's going to happen on Memorial Day?
Well, first of all, if people are interested in what we're doing, they should go to our website, which is Vietnam Full Disclosure, all one word, VietnamFullDisclosure.org. And people will see. It's mostly a work of our North Carolina chapter. Folks down there have put together an amazing chronology, a timeline, series of articles, which we update almost daily. There's always something we're finding in reference to the Vietnam War and stuff. So we've kept that very much alive. And our idea initially was, initially the Pentagon, and I think they backed off on this, but I think they initially said what they wanted to do was set up a website as an educational tool for high school and college students to better understand the war. Well, we saw that and went ballistic and said, okay, no, we're going to set up our own parallel website, which we have done. And if you go, for example, if you go to our Vietnam chronology, one of the links within our website, you'll see a whole thing listed for May 1965, for example, that you can bet your butt the Pentagon is not going to put on their timeline, right? And so that's what we're doing, you know, and that's what we want to do, and we're going to continue to do that for the next 10 years. At the same time, we're doing a number of different events. We held a number of teach-ins this past March in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of first teaching against the war. I was involved with Susan Schnall, as a matter of fact, and down at MIT a few weeks ago. So we're doing a series of those. We also sent out word to a number of different people and asked people to write letters to the wall for us to deliver on Memorial Day, which we are doing today on Memorial Day. And what we'll do is at 10:30 in the morning, we will go down to the wall and we will very solemnly, and this is not a political action, solemnly place these letters at the foot of the wall. And some of them have been written specifically to individuals whose names are on the wall, and we'll make sure that those letters are put down at the panel there. And then what we're going to do is we're going to walk out of that space and we're going to walk in symbolically to commemorate the lives of Southeast Asians who were killed during the war. And one of our North Carolina members has designed a sculpture called the Bell Tower, which he has gotten permission to put up by the reflecting pool in D.C. So we're going to be going there, and we'll have a few remarks there and whatnot. And we'll give people an opportunity to write letters. But we've gathered well over 100 letters, which are difficult to write, as I can tell you, because I wrote one myself. And we posted some of them on our website, our full disclosure website, for people to see. And they come from a whole range of different people, people who were conscientious objectors during the war, people who were war resistors, people who were too young to serve in the war, people whose fathers were in the war, as well as combat veterans have written a number of different letters.
Doug, in 1954, President Eisenhower said, because the United States was supporting the French, who were trying to keep their colony in Vietnam, and Eisenhower said that Vietnam is important to us because of their tin and their tungsten and their rubber and their rice. So they had a real economic interest in keeping that colony. And, of course, when the French lost Dien Bien Phu, the United States took over the job to keep it. And so I would totally agree with you when you say the immorality of the war. There it is. So I wanted to ask you one more time to give us the website.
Good. Yes, it's Vietnam Full Disclosure, all one word, .org. Vietnam Full Disclosure, .org.
Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Hey, good luck today on Memorial Day, Doug.
Thank you very much.
Right. Take
bye it
bye.
Easy.
Take good
yeah.
care.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.